10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needs something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I am joined today, once again, by the hosts of the Murder Sheet podcast. I have Kevin and Anya joining me from their studio. First of all, thanks, guys, for joining me again.
Well, thank you so much for having us, Bob. We're delighted to be back. Thank you.
Yeah, and this should be a probably more interesting, maybe conversation. And this is something we've been talking about for a long time. I mean, it's been probably a year since I talked about Delphi. When I had you guys on a couple weeks ago, we were talking about Temujin Kenzu. I knew very little about the case, you know, so it was nothing that I was felt really strongly about. In this case, we have, I have not read your book yet, but I'm going to read the book. I've listened to some of your content, but there was so much content with Delphi, so I haven't heard all of it. Yeah, it was all over the place. It was so hard to get, you know, accurate information as to what was going on at the trial because everybody was like posting that all the people that were there. But I believe we've got a pretty, you know, an actual real kind of disagreement about how we feel about the case. And that's why I wanted, and there's a couple of reasons. And some of this I got to give Jana and Kevin credit because I know you guys were emailing about this. There are, and I'll let you guys speak to this a little bit too before we get started, because, you know, there's in this space in general, there's a lot of hostilities that come in. Everybody kind of has their camps and their teams, not just with Delphi, with anything, right? With all the, with who their shows are, where their opinions are at. And this particular case is a hot topic for a lot of people, and people are very passionate about it. And there's just a whole lot of ugliness. And so Janet and Kevin connected outside of us. And from the way Janet kind of passed it on to me, we thought, you know, let's go ahead and have this conversation. I want to have it one. The reason I like to have these types of conversations is I feel like the listeners learn the most when there's a healthy discussion from people that disagree, because they're hearing both sides of, you know, where people are coming from. But also, this is really an intentional effort on all three of our parts to try to, the term Janet used, I don't know if that came from you, Kevin, or from her, is to try to kind of turn the temperature down on a lot of the, because I know like a lot of your listeners will come at me, I'm sure my listeners come at you anytime we're disagreeing, and to try to, you know, show like nobody's mad at anybody, we just have opinions and we're going to talk about them and walk through them. So if either one of you guys want to, or both of you want to talk about, you know, that element of it first, and then we'll move on to the case discussion.
Yeah, I think what you've said, I just want to echo it. I think there's a tendency in the true crime space, like, oh, if you're advocating, if you have questions about the trial in Delphi, you must be somebody who loves pedophiles and child killers. Mm-hmm. And if you're defending the verdict, you must be someone who's corrupt and bought and paid for by police. And I think when you get right down to it, whatever side you're on, you're a human being. You've probably arrived at your opinion legitimately, and you're just weighing different things a little bit differently. We're not evil. You're not evil. Nobody wants an innocent man to be in prison for the rest of his life. No one wants a murderer to be out walking the streets. We just weigh things a little bit differently. And as you say, it's just an honest disagreement.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly said. And also to kind of lay out the framework for people listening to, and we discussed this, I don't know which one of you I was emailing with prior to this, but, you know, the intention here is not a debate to, you know, I'm not trying to convince Kevin and Anya to come to the same conclusion I have and vice versa. The intent here is just to have a discussion and let all of you listeners have just, you know, see where everybody's coming from and maybe hear those back and forth discussions, say, okay, this is where, you know, the disagreements come from. And then y'all can just make your own determination on how you feel about the case. So that's kind of our intent going forward. I want to warn everybody before we get started, it is storming both here and down by Indianapolis where Kevin and Anya are. So hopefully we get a full episode out of this and we don't lose power. Kevin and Anya have their dogs that also don't like thunder and lightning. So we may hear some of them. See a tail wagging behind you guys.
Like the shark fin.
Yeah. So with that being said, I guess kind of the idea that I had moving forward is my audience is very familiar with my feelings on the case and the parts of the elements of the trial that I have concerns with. And for you guys to know my position on the case, I'm not fully convinced like Richard Allen is for sure an innocent guy. My position is as an investigator looking at the evidence that was presented and someone who works in wrongful convictions, I am very uncomfortable with the conviction. I'm very uncomfortable with the evidence that was used to send the man away for the rest of his life. So that doesn't necessarily mean that I think he's for sure innocent. I have not been convinced beyond a reasonable doubt based on what I have heard other people say happened at the trial, you know, as far as the evidence that was put forward. So I think what we'll do is I'll have you guys kind of go through and we'll try to, you know, kind of go like point by point where I can kind of weigh in on your thoughts. But you guys literally, in case anybody wants to read it, what is the name of your guys' book?
It's called Shadow of the Bridge, The Delphi Murders and the Dark Side of the American Heartland. It came out from Pegasus Crime on August 26, 2025. So it's been out a little while, but yeah.
And I like to jump in real quickly and say, after Richard Allen's arrest, I would say my feelings are similar to what you just articulated. Because when I read the PCA that was made publicly available after his arrest, I was concerned. I don't think I really understood what they were trying to say in the PCA. And mm-hmm. to me, it seemed weak. And I had some concerns prior to the trial. Before the trial, I think I was perceived as being anti-Richard Allen because I would go on the show and I would make remarks critical of his defense attorneys. And people would say, oh, if you don't like his attorneys, you must not like Richard Allen. And what I was trying to say, and I think I actually used these words more than once on the show, was I believe if you care about Richard Allen, if you're a family member of Richard Allen, if you're a friend of Richard Allen, you should be concerned about the quality of legal representation he's getting. And I think some people heard that and again thought I was anti-Richard Allen. But now that some of the transcripts are coming out and some people are saying, well, why didn't his trial defense do this or that? I feel in some sense my concerns about the quality of representation he got from his attorneys have been justified.
Yeah. And as you guys know, most people, what I've heard from, you know, people that are in the Richard Allen is innocent opinion, one thing that I hear echoed over and over and over again is they say that the judge Gall, they don't feel like she did a very good job and that she kept the defense from being able to put up a proper defense in the trial. So that's one of the things that we can discuss how you feel as an attorney, especially Kevin, you know, your thoughts on that. Because, you know, I'm an investigator. I'm not a lawyer. And I've heard from, you know, we've had Mata and Michael Osbrook and Andrea Burkhart on, who are all attorneys who kind of weighed in from their perspective. But I'm curious to hear your perspective as well. So I'll let you kind of take it from there. Let's get, you know, as far as evidence, because am I right that you guys both feel very strongly that Richard Allen is guilty of this crime?
Yeah, we're convinced.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Convinced. Okay. So with that being said, let's go through, if you want to start like laying out different, you know, points of evidence that you think that help shape that, form that opinion for you, and then we'll just kind of discuss them as we go.
Yes, and I will echo what Kevin said too. I think, you know, I was certainly more skeptical of the state's case going into this than I think people might imagine, because we covered this case, just to give a little background on like what we bring to the table. We covered this case since I think 2021, covered it really in depth. We broke news, like we broke national news on this, and we've been very much in the mix. And we went to, I think, all but one pretrial hearing. The pretrial hearing we missed was like 5 minutes. And one of us got into all but one of the trial sessions. We got into, for both of us, most of them, but we went to every single day of trial. We were in the Hunger Games to get seats every day.
Yeah.
We got in there and it was nuts. So we saw the trial. We were there every day. We've interviewed as many people as we could in this case. Like, I think the grand total was probably like close to 100 as far as just over the years. But as far as the evidence, I think it's important to say that I believe this case is one of those cases that does not have the big sexy piece of evidence, the murder weapon, the DNA match, right? It doesn't have those things. For me, it's a case that is quiet, sneaks up on you, and really gets more into the totality of evidence, boxing Richard Allen in to being the perpetrator rather than one thing, which makes it harder to kind of summarize in a TikTok or a news hit. It makes it harder to
right.
say.
Even in a podcast episode.
Right. We did. Absolutely. We did hundreds of episodes of the podcast. And I don't blame people for being like, that's hard to go through. I mean, I think the book actually has the benefit of being a chronological story beginning to end, but you still have to go through a whole book to kind of understand it. So it's not one of those cases that benefits from that, let's just say. For me, the three pillars of evidence that I want to talk to you about today that we find compelling kind of go back to what the prosecution's case was. And those centered around three things: the timeline of what happened that day of the murders, the cartridge found at the scene, which gets into firearms forensic evidence, which can be controversial, and we can talk about that, and Richard Allen's own words. He was in many ways the star witness against himself again and again throughout the case. And so we can talk all about those. I think just the scene set, we're talking about February 13th, 2017. I think your listeners are probably familiar with the basic outline of this, so I won't go into too much detail, but 13-year-old Abby Williams, 14-year-old Libby German, they're best friends, go on a walk in these kind of rails to trails area. It's kind of very forested. It's beautiful if you ever go there. They go up on this bridge, this old railroad bridge, and they're crossing it. It's kind of like a rite of passage for kids in that area. And they're cut off by a male. Libby's able to surreptitiously record him on her phone for a few seconds, but you don't really see a clear face. You do hear his voice. And they are found brutally killed in the forest the following day. And so that's kind of what they're looking at. It takes 5 years, I think, to get an arrest. And then he's put on trial and convicted. So that's kind of the background. But we can talk about those kind of pillars and different topics you want to hit with that as far as what ended up convincing us. Because going into trial, I had taken the opinion that this is a stronger case than it's being portrayed as. But I also kind of like, and also I felt at that point that the defense attorneys were behaving in clownish ways, which is not a good sign for their client. But at the same time, I kind of came into it being like, well, listen, they might be able to blow me away and knock some of this down enough for me to feel like, yeah, that's not beyond reasonable doubt. But I came away, like, we were outside when we knew a verdict had come down, and we were telling the news, like, hey, this is a conviction. People were shocked that we said that. They were like, really? Are you sure? And we're like, there's no way. The best case scenario in this trial would have been a hung jury, I think. And so when we heard there was a verdict, we were like, yeah, they're convicting him. We came to that conclusion over the course of the trial, I think.
Yeah. And I wasn't surprised at all, just from what I was hearing along the way, that he was convicted. As soon as I've worked enough legit wrongful conviction cases to know, when you have a recording of a confession of any kind, I mean, you I don't know what your guys' feelings, that's a whole nother discussion, but like the West Memphis 3 case, you know, there's so many people that are like, Jesse Ms. Kelly confessed, that's it, period. Like, I don't, you know, I'm never going to get past the fact that somebody confessed to a crime, despite any experts that review it. And you can go through and, you know, in that particular case, it's like, you listen to his words, he never actually said what happened. All he did was acknowledge what the police were saying. And so as soon as I knew that there was recordings of the confessions, I knew the jury was most likely going to convict. They have a real hard time getting beyond that. And truthfully, just for, so you know, guys, my position going into the trial, I was convinced 100% he was guilty. As a matter of fact, during the first couple days of the trial, I was out in the Berkshires. Josh Hallmark had a podcast festival out there, and Bob Mata had come out for a day, and I sat and talked to him a little bit. Yeah, I don't know if it was he had seen some pretrial stuff or whatever it was, but he was telling me about the case, and I told him, I'm like, dude, he's guilty. Like this guy is, like, there's nothing. I think I kept saying, if not him, then who? Like, this is ridiculous. Like, this guy is obviously guilty. So I definitely didn't go into this looking for a reason for him to be innocent. I was convinced he was guilty. It was when the trial evidence came out and I started hearing what was being presented, I just kind of had this, that's it kind of feeling. And then, you know, one area that is specialty is probably a overstatement, but you know, that where I specialize in is, you know, statement analysis. I've been trained by FBI agents and mentored over the last 10 years in that, and I have a degree in criminology. So I've, you know, so when I, you know, when I then listened to his confessions, I was like, well, that doesn't mean, you know, and we'll get into that in a minute too, right? But I was like, those confessions mean nothing to me. That's useless. And then it was like, then it came the firearms analysis. The thing that I'm most interested to hear from you guys is the timeline stuff, because that's a part that's never really been clear to me. You know, I think you guys are aware there's issues with the firearm analysis. There's certainly, you know, a lot of opinions and issues with the confessions, depending on, you know, where you fall on it. But it's certainly, most people can see there's some ambiguity there. The timeline stuff is, I'm still personally not even real clear on all of that. But anyway, that's just kind of my context going into it, where I went into it convinced he was guilty, came out of it not convinced he was innocent, but like, boy, that didn't convince me beyond a reasonable doubt. I couldn't have voted to convict.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them, while everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
And we can talk about the timeline. And I think in some ways, the timeline is the hardest to convey. And I think it was easier for us in trial because we're seeing like maps and timestamps right. And all these different things. Whereas when you're just conveying it, it can sound underwhelming. But the picture it paints is so compelling that when we talk to members of the jury after this is all over, obviously not during the trial, but after this is all over, when we had conversations with them, they were people who said basically, I mean, you had at least one juror who was concerned enough about forensic firearms examination as a whole that they were like not going to convict based on that. And they were like, okay, I'm going to set that aside. What do I look at? And I feel like the timeline is what actually sunk Richard Allen to a certain degree. So let's talk about the timeline. When we're talking about this, you know, Richard Allen initially came forward days after the murders, when this first happened. That tip was lost. It was put in wrong. And, you know, it was basically a cluster in the early days of too many cooks in the kitchen, too many investigators. I see it as a systemic problem rather than any one individual's fault, but it's certainly very unfortunate because I think it delayed things for 5 years. Anyway, so they lose this tip, but in that tip, he's telling the person he's talking to, Dan Doolin of the DNR, that he was there. He was there around 1:30. He puts his time there, just going on a walk, you know, which is something people do. That's not terribly unusual. And it was a very nice day out that day. So he puts himself there around 1:30. And what investigators find is when they look at this one piece of surveillance footage, remember, this is a very rural area, like surveillance footage. It's not like a big city. So like they have limited options, but they have a Hoosier Harvest store out there. It's got continuous video running, looking at the road, and they can identify at the timestamp, I think it was like 1:27, like right around 1:30, they see what looks like Allen's Ford Focus, even with his specific tire rims that they had. They don't have a license plate. They can't specifically say this is definitely his car, but when he's putting himself there and at that time, and they're seeing that, that seems important. Another thing that, and also it fits with the description of how, like basically the way he described getting there and parking and where he was, it would make sense that he would be captured on the Hoosier Harvest Store video, you know, going that direction in that way. So that all makes sense. That hangs together. Then we go into witnesses. So there are a number of trail witnesses. They all describe Bridge Guy as subtly different, but you know from your work on this that that is pretty not uncommon with witnesses.
Right.
I want to emphasize one thing. None of these witnesses are used to say, Richard Allen was the guy I saw, which makes sense because they all, you know, they had very brief interactions with this person, brief glimpses. They're not thinking I'm going to be a witness in a murder case. So They're not taking a lot in. But what's important is that Richard Allen's own words end up really hurting him with them. So one group is a group of four girls, okay? There's four girls. I think it's like three teens and then one like little girl, one of their sisters is with them. She's kind of running around. She's very small. So they're together. And we know they're together because they're taking pictures too. And those pictures are getting timestamped. So we're able to almost follow them through their pictures and see what time they're in different places. They become important because they tell police, we saw the guy in Libby's video. You know, we saw this guy and then we recognized him from Libby's video. That's the guy we saw. And he was going toward the bridge when we were kind of leaving. So that's interesting. But of course, if they don't have anyone to compare that to, can't really do much with that. Well, Richard Allen, in his initial statement to Dan Doolin, he says, I saw a group of girls. He identifies them as three girls. But I mean, there's no other group of girls around there. I mean, like, to me, people make a big deal, three versus four. To me, that doesn't matter. You're dealing with one little kid who's kind of in the middle of this. I think, you know, in a fleeting interaction, it doesn't really matter. The other thing is he also notes one of them had, you know, long, dark hair, which fits one of the witnesses exactly. And he's saying he saw them. He had this interaction with them.
And I think it's important to stress that investigators worked really hard to identify everybody out on the trails that day. And they succeeded years before in identifying everybody except Bridge Guy. So we know what groups of girls were there. We know who was there. We have identified everybody except for this one man. And so if you want to postulate that, oh, they must have seen the real killer and Richard Allen saw another group of girls, then you have to imagine that there was another group of girls that no one else saw. And that there was another person dressed like Bridge Guy other than Richard Allen that no one else saw.
But more than that, the fact that the girls are on their phones are placing them there, their pictures are placing them there, it makes the timeline a lot tighter because they're very much there around that 1:30 mark when he's showing up. And so you have these two groups meeting each other. And that's not the only, and they found him very creepy, right? Because, you know, he comes up to them. I think one of them says hi to him. And he just gives her like a death glare, it was a creepy interaction. And that's not the only group of people that Richard Allen happens to have this kind of weird thing with. There's another witness, an older woman who's kind of just exercising. She's seen there, her car seen on the video. We know she was there. And Richard Allen, in his statements to police, he puts himself on the first platform of the bridge. You know, he says, I go out there, I'm looking at fish in the river, in the creek rather. And I'm looking there, whatever. I mean, that's fine. I think people do that. But what's significant is he's doing it on that day. And we hear from this older woman, Betsy Blair. She walks out there. She gets out to the bridge area. She sees a guy standing on the first platform. She says he seems to be waiting for someone. And he looks at her. She looks at him. And then she continues on her way. She identifies that man as the guy in Libby's video. Again, she gives a different like sketch description, but when we talk about that, we have to notice that some of the witnesses are younger, significantly younger. She's older. She sees a younger looking man. She describes kind of a baby face guy. The younger witnesses describe like a scruffier looking middle-aged guy. To me, when you're talking about like minute, like little interactions like that, I don't care about sketches. I don't like sketches as a whole, like in any case. The sketches in like another case we did, the Burger Chef, I don't care about a witness's fleeting memory. I care, do they think that they saw Bridge Guy, the guy in Libby's video? And they all say the same thing. Yes, we saw Bridge Guy.
Before we move on past those two, just a couple things that I just want to clarify.
Yeah.
Because I don't know.
Yeah.
One is you said they identified everybody that was at the bridge. Was it confirmed through that process that there was no group of three girls?
Yeah.
Is that fact? We know that.
I mean, yeah. And like you, and again, when we're talking about this is all happening, it's not like we're just talking about like for hours and hours. Like this is all in the 1:30-ish area where we know that these girls were there. Like, and we know that he's saying,
I just want to make sure, like, I'm just, you know, from the, like, an investigative standpoint, what can we eliminate? Like, you know, was it confirmed they talked to everybody there? There was no group of three, meaning that whoever Richard Allen said he talked to had to been them, that's fact. So and they identified that it was not that it was Richard Allen, but that it was the guy in that picture.
Yes. And they don't, you know, they are never used to say, that's the man I saw. There's no,
right. No one ever was, right?
No one ever was.
No one ever was.
No positive.
And I want to stress, not only did the prosecution not say, do you recognize that man as Richard Allen? The prosecution did not ask that question. The defense did not ask that question either.
Yeah.
Right.
So
it would be a risky question for either one of them to ask.
Exactly. It would have been very risky. So no one went that far. But you have what you're seeing here is Richard Allen starting to put himself in places that we know Bridge Guy was at the time we know Bridge Guy was there. And there's no indication, nobody saying, well, we saw two guys kind of dressed similarly running around. Like everyone's saying, I saw Bridge Guy. And Richard Allen helpfully is saying, I was there, you know, and I think that's what I say. He's the worst witness for himself. He really boxes himself into a pretty tight timeline. And I want to note with that lady, Betsy Blair, we know this. She sees Bridge Guy in a place where Richard Allen places himself. And then she, on the way back, she turns back. Who's coming down the trail towards her, toward the bridge? Libby and Abby. So this is all tighter than I think people think. There's not a lot of room for some other mysterious forces to be coming in, you know, whether they be Odinists or another single killer. It's just, I think he got boxed in.
Yeah, as I'm like ticking things off in my mind, I'm like, okay, what can we say are fact that Betsy Blair saw who most likely was Bridge Guy and then saw Libby and Abby walking towards the bridge. So like all that fits, you know, we haven't tied that in that's definitely Richard Allen, but these are facts that we can kind of rest on. The Bridge Guy was probably waiting there based on what Betsy Blair saw, based on what the group saw, same guy, Libby and Abby are coming. That's the guy that she saw on the bridge is probably Bridge Guy. Yep. Whether or not that's Richard Allen. There's one thing I just remember what I wanted to circle back to. Are you guys familiar with when I had Michael Osbrook on, he talked about and he showed me some pictures that were pretty compelling. You know, the surveillance footage of the Ford Focus from the Hoosier Farm and Fleet or whatever that was of the car. And then pictures of Richard Allen's car, which at a glance looked like the same car. But then, you know, he brought in, we started looking at details as far as like, and I'm trying to remember exactly like where the taillight was at, where the, you know, where the wheel well was compared to the window and things. And, you know, and he kind of posited to me like, that's not the same car, which at first glance, I'm like, it looks like the same car. And then when I look closer, I'm like, oh, there were a couple of very distinct elements that made it that it actually could not have been the same car. Are you guys familiar with any of that?
Yeah. And I got to confess, I don't find it compelling at all. And especially since, I mean, we're not talking about they're just finding a random guy in town and saying, well, that's your car. I mean, he's saying I arrived there at this time. You know, like we're hearing from him that he was there. He told his wife he was there, told his wife he went on the bridge, seemingly kind of backtracked on that later. But with Michael Osbrook, I mean, being someone who's worked, you know, for the defense team in that case, you know, I just think there's some motivated reasoning going on there, to be honest. Like, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree.
I understand what he's saying, but I just don't. His vehicle analysis is not compelling to me.
The problem is, for both sides, frankly, is that the quality of the images in that
surveillance
footage is bad. And I could imagine a person of fair mind just struggling with it. I can point to things. I think the tire rims that show up in those images are very unique and match Richard Allen's vehicle. But people in good faith can say these images are just too blurry.
They are blurry. And I would certainly not say I would be convicting anyone based on just this. I think for me, that's where it kind of builds into the totality. Because you can maybe say, well, okay, this isn't quite it. To me, when everything comes together, it's like a stool with three legs, right? And it's like that, you know, if you have one missing, it's going to fall over. But it's starting, you can probably tell, like, even if you don't quite get to that place of beyond a reasonable doubt, you can see it's starting to become problematic for Allen.
Yeah. And for me, it's like, again, it's not to a point where I'm like, well, I don't believe this or that I think there's some kind of corruption, but like a gap for me when I'm trying to really, you know, to close all these gaps in my mind. You know, I did quite a bit of analysis on his recorded police interviews once they went out too, you know. And of course there he's, you know, they're like, well, you said you were there at 1:30. He's like, no, I was there at 12:30. And they're like, well, this was in the original statement. And I was like hoping that from the original statement we had a recording or something, but we just have the notes from a DNR officer And it's like, well, I can't. And again, that's not to say it's not worth looking at. I'm not saying that. But for me, it's like, I really wish I could be sure that he actually said 130 the first time. Because a lot of this timeline stuff we're talking about, like he put himself there, this car there. These girls saw bridge guy, not necessarily him. It's like, well, what if the three people he talked to were there an hour and a half earlier or something like that? You know, that's just one of the things that I just wish I knew for a fact that's what he said.
Yeah, I certainly wish there was a recording of that initial interview too. I will say one thing we understood, and you know, it's a bit confusing with all the driving around and his different statements, because you do mention, yeah, he gives a different time later subsequently. One thing, earlier interviews tend to be more accurate because your memory is fresher. But as you said, we can't know that that's actually what he said because we have the record. You know, we don't have the recording. For me, one thing I understood from talking with people is that, you know, what he describes in later interviews, his car should have appeared on Hoosier Harvest Store anyway at whatever time he was talking about. And from what I know, the car that resembles him, his that appears, is appearing at that 127 timestamp. So it's like, where's his car? If he's saying, I did this route that would have taken me past this store.
I genuinely don't know the answer to this, but I remember when I was watching a police interview, there was a lot of discussion about the officer, the detective was like, well, you came here. And he was like, he's like, no, I drove from this way. And I don't remember all the details. I just remember there was a lot of back and forth about which direction he came from. Would either way have put him past that camera, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
I don't think so. But I think he describes parking at this old CPS building, they called it, which is where people saw a vehicle. Now, people saw all kinds of vehicles. I don't find that terribly compelling. And again, it's the witness sightings thing where it's like, I saw this and that. And it's like, OK, people did see a car there, though. And, you know, it was unusual. It's abandoned. You know, someone was parking there potentially to go to the trails. My understanding is, like, if he's parking over there, then, you know, there's, you know, indications of where is his vehicle on that footage. But, you know, and again, it's where the totality comes into play, because it's like, yeah, could they say, well, that wasn't recorded? Sure. But when then we also are dealing with things like the forensic firearms examination and his confessions. Now, I agree with you, and we can I want to get to the forensic firearms thing first, but I agree with you. To me, just because someone says they did something, they didn't necessarily do it, especially if there's mental health issues, especially if they're in a coercive environment of like being grilled by a tough detective who is just keep adding, you know, harassing them for hours and hours and hours. And they're just, you know, whatever, I did it. But there's reasons to believe his confessions, notably one detail that he gets that no one else could have known but the killer. Like, it's, I mean, to me, for a lot of people, that was it. I want to say one thing, though. I mean, it's more of a common sense thing. I don't consider this evidence, though. When we heard his voice in court, that is Bridge Guy's voice. We've listened to that audio again and again and again and again and again. To me, when I heard him, you know, on the jail calls, this is a call from Ricky. You know, I was, oh my, it was something, you know. But to me, I kind of disregarded that because it's not enough. I mean, I don't really trust like vocal analysis anyway. Like, I don't, how scientific is that? But just from my own like feeling of like, oh, Jesus, you know, when I heard him talk, when I saw how he looked and compared with the video, there's just a level there of like, it looks and sounds like him just from a common sense perspective. But that's not evidence. It's just more of how I like look at it to a certain extent. But forensic firearms, you know, that's something that, as you mentioned, controversial, has been. You know,
real quick before we jump into, I just want to make sure that I didn't derail you guys. As far as timeline stuff, is the Betsy Blair and the surveillance video, does that connect all the dots for you guys on the, as far as timeline stuff, or was there anything else I'm missing?
There's a
time. And his statement.
Sarah Carbaugh is another witness. She sees it, the aftermath, seemingly. She's going down the side of the street in her car and, you know, nearby and encounters this guy who's muddy and bloody. She's kind of on the stand, is like, well, at first you just said muddy, later you added bloody. She's adamant that she was misrecorded, or like basically that she had always said bloody, but she was mumbling. She didn't come forward for a couple months because she said she was extremely anxious and scared, which I believe, by the way. I mean, like, people have different kind of anxiety levels. But she was somebody who kind of made the whole, like, I think, I forget the exact time. I want to say she saw this guy around 3:59. Again, doesn't identify Richard Allen. Her sketch was the closest in terms of what he looks like, though. And she got pretty close to him in her car. he's kind of walking away. He's kind of got his head down, like he doesn't want anyone to see her. But, you know, this is a guy who's kind of departing the area around that time, which kind of makes sense that you'd want to get out of there, because pretty quickly there's a big ass search going on, you know, all right. over, you know, where people are coming out to help find these girls, and everyone thinks it's an accident. Nobody thinks it's a murder at that point. But
is there anything as far as timeline? Then we'll move on to the firearm stuff. The tough question that I always ask, like when people pitch cases to me that they think a wrongful conviction, I always like push back the other way. Is there any evidence? And this isn't a trick question. It's not like I have something on my sleeve. I'm curious.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence you came across or that came out at trial that cut against the timeline? Like, was there anything that maybe something that you think is not, you know, you're not weighing it as much, but was there anything else that came out that cuts against that timeline theory?
Yeah. I think one thing that came out in trial, where the defense presented a lot of different people who are at the trails at different times, and they would kind of put them up there and they'd be like, yeah, I was probably there around like 2 or 3. And, you know, I didn't hear anything. Where was the screaming? You know, I didn't see anything. And like one woman they put up there, and she seemed to be having like serious memory loss issues. And she said, I saw a guy near the crime scene, like on the other side of the creek at like 8 a.m. And it was like, it was really, I don't know. I felt it was kind of just meaningless, because then inevitably the cross-examination was, well, you initially told police that you were there from 3 to 4. And I'd be like, yeah, I guess I did. Okay, well, that's not the timeline. Like Libby's phone, this is actually really important. Libby's phone stops moving at 2:32. Okay. Mm-hmm. Her phone is found under a shoe, which is under Abby. So like after that stops moving, I think it's fair to say that they were killed very close around that time if the phone is.
So in other words, if you were there at 3 p.m.
doesn't matter.
You wouldn't have heard any screams because they're likely already deceased.
So they had their people.
And if you're talking about someone who may have seen someone there at 8 a.m., that's about 6.5 hours before the murder. So that isn't really terribly relevant unless you can demonstrate that that's a person who stayed there until the murder.
Which they couldn't. And that woman, again, really struggled on the stand. It was kind of depressing to watch. But I would say that, yeah, they tried to do that. And I mean, I think they should try. That's their job. It's like they didn't really make any of that go anywhere. And it was just sort of like, okay, so all these people weren't there at the correct time. Who cares?
Right.
Like, but yeah, the timeline of her phone not moving anymore, I think, is important. And I think, I don't know the timestamp, but in between there, Libby's Apple data shows like a descent. So you see them, the timestamp on the video, I believe, for them getting kidnapped is 2:13. There's some kind of descent as if they're going downhill. And then they end up crossing the creek. And by 2:32, it's all over. So like we're talking 2:13 to 2:32 is when the majority.
And I've heard the when it stopped moving before. And I had in my mind, I was thinking like GPS. And I was like, well, that doesn't necessarily mean it's over. But you guys were, when they were talking about it not move, are they talking about like the geo, whatever that term is, like physically the phone did not move anymore after that?
That's a good
question. What does it didn't move anymore mean?
I think it's like something pretty exact. Because I know what you mean. Like the phone pings, like who cares? Like that could put you anywhere, right? I think it's something more like specific to
that. Yeah, that was something that the defense tried to raise. They tried to suggest that the phone would only track, maybe I'm off of my recollection, but that it would only track
people
like
walking,
like steps people take, and not if someone was driving. Because the defense tried to posit the theory that when they went down the hill, they got into a car.
Yes.
And they said the way you're talking about tracking this phone, it wouldn't have tracked movement in a car.
Apple data doesn't show like steps when you're driving. It only shows steps when you're walking around.
But I would think that, and I'm guessing, but I would think that the like a forensic analysis of the phone because you know your phone, I'm losing the term right now. It's geo or gyro or something, but yeah, it tracks every.
Yeah.
That's why you can turn it, and you know, for a compass and everything else. So so I'm going to assume not moving anymore, especially because if they're talking about steps, it's that and not GPS, because GPS has a span, right?
I believe it's the steps. I believe it's like there's no activity.
So it's like the phone like hit a spot and it was
Right.
Not moving
and
at all.
And of course, it's important to remember we're talking about 2017 phones, which probably weren't as sophisticated as the phones we have now.
I will say, like, you know, the defense had this whole thing. Their thing was that they were taken away in a vehicle and then brought back like later, and that they had this thing where their timeline was, well, you know, I think like around after 5 p.m., someone plugs in something to the headphone jack of the phone. And I can tell you, I've had iPhones like, when they said that, and when I saw like the state of the phone in the pictures, it's like, it's this dirt in the headphone jack. Like, that's obvious. Like, this moisture, dirt, this thing's filthy because they've just been abducted and crossed a creek and it's dropped on the ground, rather. To me, that just was like, okay, so we're saying that the phone stops moving at 2:32. They take them away somehow and then come back to that phone and I just thought it was kind of silly. And the idea of them being,
I think that theory is nonsense, by the way.
It's stupid. I don't mean to be like, to me, like what you're saying is like, hey, let's have reasonable doubt. Like that, I understand that and I respect that because I feel like that's intellectually honest. But like, so much about the defense's theory. Do you want us to talk about Judge Gull? Because we can do, I mean, like,
well,
I
let's do this. Let's move through the firearm stuff. We'll get through the 3 points.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
So firearms, I think one thing is important to know. Kevin and I are not gun people. So we really tried to rely on people who are when we were talking about this. Like even listeners might reach out and say, okay, here's, you know. So one very good question people often ask us is, why is firearms evidence even a thing here when we know for a fact that Abby and Libby, they were killed with a knife or they were killed with a sharp object? And that's a good question. The reason why there's reason to believe that a gun was used in this crime is largely because of Libby's video. So you have this situation where on the video, you see bridge guy approaching across the bridge. He's kind of following Abby and you hear the girls talking. It's a little bit hard to make out what they're saying at times, but we kind of have listened to this on headphones on repeat. And at some point you hear Libby say something to the effect of that be a gun, almost like she's warning Abby of like, that guy has a gun. Like, when I hear their voices, I've been in situations where there's like a threatening man around and you almost are kind of like, da, 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 da. If I act normal, maybe he'll act normal. And, you know, oh, hey, you know, like kind of you're trying to sound like everything's fine when it's not. And so she's kind of saying that'd be a gun. And you hear guys. And then I believe at that point you hear this kind of metallic sound, which we believe sounds like a gun being racked and down the hill. And so what I think the state's theory and what we actually believe at this point is that this guy approaches them, threatens them with this gun, racks it to look intimidating, because that's pretty intimidating, and forces them at gunpoint to go down the hill, go across the creek where he kills them on the other side with a sharp-edged weapon. So that is why there's reason to believe. So they find a unspent round, a cartridge, at the crime scene. It's been a lot
of the body, but down where the bodies were found, not up by the bridge, right?
Yeah. Not by the bridge where the bodies were found. And what we've understood from talking with people who know guns is that if you almost rack it once, and then you'd go and maybe rack it again, like maybe you're losing control of something and you kind of are like, hey, you know, stop it, that can eject a cartridge at that point. In his confession, Alan even indicates, like, I did something to the gun, like something must, you know, like something must have come out at that point.
That particular, everything you just said right there is something worth noting, because I think it is that whole interaction in the video, the that be a gun, the racking of the, you know, I did a whole episode. I mean, I had it up on the sound waves, analyzing the sound waves, did recreations with guns to try to, you know, figure it out. my opinion is, I don't remember. I'd have to go back and listen. Yeah. I did not. My assessment wasn't that she said that be a gun. She said, I thought she said something different. I don't remember what it was. I'd have to go back and listen. That was a year ago or whenever I went over that. I did not hear the gun wreck. I tried to hear it. I tried to recreate it. I tried to, you know, Zach and I both have guns. So we were, you know, taking our iPhones and different, you know, and then analyzing the sound waves and not necessarily sound exactly the same, but look at like where the spikes are and all that. All that being said, I think you can have an informed opinion about it, but I just don't. The conclusion I came to was no one can know. No one can know if that's what she said or if that was a gun. I think that some people have an informed opinion that she said that be a gun and they heard a gun. I think that some people also have an informed opinion that heard her say something else and it wasn't a gun. I think it could go. I just don't see that in my, when I went through it and I spent a week on it, you know, just going through it, analyzing it over and over and over again, every way, cleaned up audio. I couldn't get to a point where like that is concrete one way or the other for me.
Yeah, I think for me it is just, I mean, I hear her saying gun. I some people have said they think she's saying Abby a gun, like for saying her friend's name and then a gun. For me, I think she's saying that be a gun. Like when I listen,
I wish I remembered what it was that I, and again,
yeah, that's curious just, what you thought she might be saying. I remember we heard the rack in the court, but then we were kind of like, man, maybe we're just hearing, and we listened to it afterwards, like after the exhibits came out, and we were like, oh yeah, like I thought it sounded that way. But anyway, so we do find a cartridge at the crime scene. There's misinformation about that out there. I think originally reported that like that was out there for days and they didn't collect it and it was buried and all this stuff. That's not true. Like they found it when they processed the scene. They saw it glittering, you know, and it's unspent. So I just want to be clear, like it wasn't shot. It was cycled through the gun, but it was ejected. So when that happens with a cartridge, my understanding is that there's the, like, I think there's different, like the, I used to know all these terms, like ejector pin. There's like, you know, there's different tools within the gun that almost mark it and it's ejected, but it's not usual evidence. Normally we're hearing from fired rounds or, you know, bullets.
Like from the spiraling and the barrel and, you know, that stuff. Yeah,
exactly. I'm aware of a case in Kaufman County, Texas, where they used an unspent round similarly, where someone was going around killing prosecutors, and that was a whole different case. But it's not unheard of, but it's unusual. And so they had the Indiana State Police Laboratory, Melissa Oberg, she was the examiner, do this. I think that test has been criticized because people note that she used fired rounds and then would cycle those through. And I understand that. I think for me, our understanding from talking with people who know how forensic firearm examination works basically said that it's just easier to see the marks when you use a fired round when you're comparing, but it doesn't change the nature of the marks. That was what they said. And as far as the defense, they had an expert who was kind of critical of her viewpoints. One thing we learned about was in this world, you're really, they say like pictures are not what you're supposed to be looking at. You're supposed to be almost like looking at it yourself and analyzing it, just like that's the way it's done. I thought something that was highly significant for me was I was kind of waiting for their defense expert to say, hey, I examined the bullet and it's not a match. Like that would have been huge for me. But it came out that they didn't even want him, like they didn't have him do that. Like they didn't want him to look at the bullet and do his own analysis. They just wanted him to kind of shoot down what she and her supervisor who confirmed her results said. She and her supervisor both looked at it separately and, you know, came to the same conclusion. I don't know. And to me also, I think with Richard Allen, again, we're own worst enemy, because I think we could all understand, like, you know, he talked about how he would go like hunting mushrooms and he would bring his firearm, and police were giving him all these outs of like, hey, like, would you bring your gun around that place and maybe do that? Because you could see like maybe he sees something and gets scared and, you know, like drops it by accident. No, I wouldn't have done that. Did you let anyone borrow your gun? No. You know, I mean, like, I think he gave up by the end in that interview. I think he had given up and was just kind of like, whatever. But
my read on that his police interview was it was the first time that I watched it where I really started to, that's when I started really leaning towards, I'm not so sure this guy did it. And it was because of, you know, I've had extensive training in read technique and interrogation techniques and all that. And I'm like watching the detective set the traps for him in all the ways that you expect a guilty and sometimes not guilty people to react to that. And Richard Allen's reaction to it, for me, and again, this isn't like concrete evidence because it's just a statement analysis and he could just be a brilliant liar and there are a million different ways this could go. But, you know, when they got to the part about the gun and they're like, did you have the gun? Yeah. Did anybody borrow it? Nope. Like he's not giving them all the excuses, because usually that's, you know, read, that's what's happening, right? You're giving them these outs. You're trying to box them in. You're trying to get them to tell you something that you can later prove to them is wrong. And he's not falling for it. He's just going, no one borrowed my gun. I have my gun. But then when they put him into the, you know, there's an element in, I don't know how familiar you guys are. You probably are because of what you do with Reed technique. You know, you put him into the position where then you confront them with the irrefutable evidence. Right. And that's like when you're dropping the hammer on them and they're like, we have your bullet from your gun. It's proven. It has to be there. And then they start offering the ways out. Like maybe you were there doing target practice. And his reaction to that was compelling to me just from a statement analysis perspective, because he just keeps saying, that's impossible. No, it's not. Well, tell us how it was there if it wasn't for murdering them. It wasn't. It's impossible. There's no way. He just kept saying over and over again, like, there's no possible way. And what you expect, what you hope for in a Reed technique interrogation is that they're going to give you some sort of excuse. Because, you know, Reed technique is a slow burn, step-by-step process. And that's the point where you're trying to, let me just get them on the scene. Let me get them to, you know, that, and other examples, right? So maybe you didn't push her down the stairs. Did she just fall down the stairs? And they say, yeah, so now I've got you. Now I've put you there. Now right. You're there. And that's what they were doing at that point in the interview by telling him, like, give me some other innocent reason why this bullet was there. And his reaction to it was contrary to what you are hoping, I shouldn't say expect, what you're hoping for in Reed technique, which is for him to give you an excuse. And instead, he just kept saying, there's no fucking way. It's impossible. There's no way my bullet was on that scene. That didn't happen. It's not possible.
Right. I felt, to me, the thing that stood out about that interview was when his wife comes in and sort of says, you told me you were on the bridge. And he's like, what? Like, yeah. He reacts with such exasperation. She's crying and he's just like, I love you anyway. But
I'm curious, when we talk about his interactions with his wife, he doesn't tell her, I didn't do this.
No.
He says, I know that you know I didn't do this. What did you make of that?
Not much. I mean, there's nothing, there's very specific things I'm looking for in an interview like that. And when it gets to like interacting with another person like that, unless other than if like they're confessing, you know, there's just, for me, there's too many variables, because you're dealing with, you know, is he just trying to comfort her? Is he trying to convince her of something? You know, there's too many, for me, there's too many variables to put much weight into any of that. Because, you know, in our mind, we're like, this is all about the crime. You know, take Richard Allen out of it, right? Some other interview, their wife comes in. And, you know, if that person is innocent or guilty or whatever, they could be, you know, well, I don't want her to be upset. I'm not worried about getting arrested for this, but now, or maybe I lied to her for some other reason, or I'm trying to convince her that, like, now I'm scared because they're talking about arresting me. So I need her to say something, you know, even if I'm an innocent person, to say, you know, there's just too many variables out there for me to put much weight into that stuff, unless there was like something very direct that was said about the crime.
I think, I will tell you, and I totally respect your difference of opinion, but when we, after that day, I remember like talking with some women who had been in the gallery, like spectators, but also some journalists, and they were like, that was, you know,
yeah.
They were like, that did not come across very well. But anyway, so that's the firearms thing. They checked other guns. I want to say, like, this was not the only other gun that had come up in the investigation. They had compared the found cartridge to. Others had come up. I think some were deemed inconclusive. Others were deemed not a match, or like not at all, right? They had a couple of firearms that they came up with from a river search that basically fell apart. Like they weren't able to test them. So those, I think, were some of the inconclusive ones as well. But this was the one that they got that, you know, like, I mean, that they felt was consistent, that the market, the classification, you know, the different classifications and the markings on the ejector pin and like the various components that were, they were able to match, given that it was an unspent round, that they felt it was, you know, consistent with that and that they testified to it. So I mean, I think it's good to be skeptical of any sort of forensic evidence and not necessarily put all the weight on it. I think the fact for me that they didn't even try to like say this bullet, you know, or this rather this cartridge, you know, we looked at it ourselves and here's what we said. To me, that was kind of took the air out of the sails for me on the defense's point. Although I will say, as I mentioned, at least one of the jurors we know for a fact set the cartridge aside and made their decision more on everything else that we learned. But yeah.
So the firearms evidence for me was definitely in the category of, certainly it's not, oh, well, this proves he didn't do it. I mean, even if it didn't come from his gun, it doesn't prove he didn't do it. But as far as the weight I could put on it, it was a few things. One, just in general, you know, firearms analysis is shaky at best when you're even looking at like striations. You know, there's some case law out there to question that a little bit. As far as like the ejector thing, the issues, there were a number of issues. Not that they did anything wrong, but as far as like the weight of it. So my understanding is they replicated ejecting the rounds. What, four times or something like it, four or six times that they tried, you know, just ejecting around, which is what happened to that round, and compared them, and they weren't able to make a determination from that. So it didn't create the tool markings that his gun, by just doing what happened to that bullet, did not create the tool marks they were looking for. Then they fired it, and that, so, and you guys are, as far as like the ejection goes, the in that gun, the firing process is what ejects it. So they fire it and ejects it. And then there was, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but there was a number of those that they, it was, I feel like one was four and one was six. I don't remember which was which. But then of the fired rounds, did she do a total of like 9 or 10 rounds?
I don't remember the exact number.
It was something like that. And this was from what I was reading about it. And of the ones she fired, you know, there was one, or I think it was one or two of them, they were able to say that there were marks left on it that were consistent enough that his gun couldn't be excluded from it, which is, you know, people on the innocent side are like, well, that's really weak. Well, I mean, that's just the terminology they use.
Yeah.
They're not gonna say it was his gun. It couldn't be excluded. I have an issue with that just because the entire mechanism is completely, you know, the gun, now the round is getting hot, it's expanding, it's soft. There's a lot of different things that are happening than if you just eject one. So that they compared an unspent to a spent gave me some pause. But then it was, after all that, you know, whether you accept the methodology or not, it was his gun couldn't be excluded. But didn't she also like acknowledge on the stand that there were other guns that also couldn't be excluded from it?
I think those were in a different category from what we understand. I mean, like they can't, you're absolutely right. They can no longer, and nor should they, say this is a match, right?
Right.
Like, that's not, I mean, we all agree that I think that's overstating things, and we want this to be as scientific as possible. And when we had an era where we were like overstating forensic evidence, I think that led to a lot of problems across the board. But with this one, I mean, they looked at it and like this was the one that was, if I mean, I'll call it a match because I'm not a scientist, but this is the one that they felt was like, this matches what we saw.
Was there, am I wrong in this? Because I thought I had read among, I feel like I read a direct quote from her that said, where she kind of acknowledged that many different guns could have, because the markings weren't so unique that it was specific to his, that there were like other weapons of the same, the same brand, same category, whatever. I don't remember the term she used.
Yeah.
But then also I thought I read something that like Brad Weber's gun also couldn't be excluded. Am I wrong about that?
I thought they excluded that.
But
it was excluded. Okay, so
I thought it was, but I'll tell you, they early on, I think they thought they were looking at a 6 hour, you know, like just from what they were seeing. But I forget the exact terminology, but within this, there's different categories and there's certain agreements in tools that are like, I think they're like subclass versus class. So like, it's sort of like all guns of the Sig Sauer variety might have these things because they all are Sig Sauer. And then all the guns in a certain batch might have these similarities because they're in the same batch. But then there's other ones that are below that get into more of the individual weapon. And when you have a forensic firearms examination, you're really wanting to look at those. Those are the most important. If you're just saying, well, you know, let's go based on these like higher up classes, that might just be something that all Sig Sauers might have, or that might be something that's similar based on this. So I think they're trying to look at like deeper than that. And I think that's what, you know, what they were kind of focusing on. And I think on the defense side, they were kind of critical of like, well, maybe some of the things that you say are unique might actually be more, you know, more general. They might be all the guns in the same batch, or they might be a more, and I'm using the wrong terminology and I apologize. It's been a while. But I think there was an element of that, of like, she felt like it was getting down to the individual firearm characteristics. The defense was trying to pull it out to be more broad, but, and that's kind of where some of the disagreement, I think, was coming into things. But some of the things she's looking at are naturally going to be like those broad similarities. And that's not what she was basing like necessarily her findings on entirely. Does that, I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And this is one of the areas where like, I wish I was there at the trial to see it all. Cause everything was like secondhand, and it was like a quote that I read at one of the news companies that were, or the news organizations that were there, that I thought I remember again, you know, over a year ago, you know, where it was, you know, that she acknowledged on the stand that it, you know, it could have been, it wasn't like, because the term you want to hear is his gun cannot be excluded. And, you know, I don't remember exactly the term, but basically like, but it couldn't have come from any other. We see it with like DNA, like it's one in so many trillion people. It could have been there.
Yeah.
He and can't I don't be think excluded to the exclusion of all others.
Yeah. I don't think they're allowed to do that anymore with forensic firearms examinations because they haven't looked at all the guns in the world.
Right. Yeah. And it's always easier. Like this is, it just ended up being one of those things that just became very ambiguous to me where it was like, and the gun was one, you know, when we first heard about his arrest, you know, what we heard was they matched a bullet from his gun. And I'm like, well, that's your guy. And so I was expecting that. And then when the trial testimony came out, because I was still at the point when that happened, when that part of the trial was happening, where I was still convinced he was 100% guilty. And so I'm expecting, well, okay, here comes the firearms analysis. This will put the nail in the coffin. And then for me, I was like, wait, what? Like, that's how strong the firearm analysis is, that if we managed to fire a round out of a gun and compare it to a bullet that wasn't fired out of the gun, that it can not be excluded as that gun, but also other guns can't be excluded from it either. So that means Richard Allen's innocent. But for me, it was like, that makes it really hard for me to put a whole lot of weight into that element of evidence. And I don't know if you guys, but I was an arson investigator for 15 years. So I'm fully aware of the overstate, you know, that to me, that's what, you know, arson investigation is considered junk science in a lot of places. And I've always said the reason for that is because of so many arson investigators trying to overstate what they can prove, and it becomes junk science. You know, like I can tell you that, you know, in a high percentage of likelihood that the point of origin of that fire was in that corner at that level. I can't tell you who started it or when they started it or any of those things in the, you know, people trying to go, you know, and same thing with firearms analysis too. I'm sure it doesn't, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And we agree. And I just don't think it should be overstated. I think a lot of what I remember, it was one point where she was testifying where it was like, had she gotten those initial guns she looked at that she couldn't exclude, but also there, it didn't look to be a good match. Had she gotten those at the same time as Allen's Sig Sauer, she would have been able to exclude them because the Sig Sauer was a significantly better match or was more consistent with some of those class characteristics that we're talking about. I mean, my view, just in layperson's terms, is that she testified that it was a match, you know, like that this, but within the context of, you know, not overstating it and not violating the ethics of her profession. I think, you know, that was kind of what we took away from it. But yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely a fascinating thing. And I don't know guns at all. So we definitely had to read up on that for the book.
Well, that's a good, this is a good point for us to wrap up this episode, and then we'll move on to next week's. But I think this is a really good demonstration of how, you know, people can come to different conclusions, because we're talking about the same evidence and just have different views on how, you know, what it means to us. It's not that we're, you know, looking at things completely different, but like for me, that's not strong enough for me to be convinced it came from his gun. You guys feel a lot more strongly about it. And so you can see how those, you know, the opinions on the case start to drift in different directions when you do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. And we'll be right back next week to continue on where we'll get into the confessions and anything is Judge Gall and anything else we want to yap about.
Heck yeah.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Woodyomnik, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino, the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.